Short disclaimer. This podcast is in no way affiliated with the Stars production or Diana Gabaldon. All views expressed are solely our own. Welcome to the Outlander podcast,
where the men are kilted, the women are winsome,
and the whiskey is neat. Welcome to episode 49 of the Outlander podcast. I'm Ginger.
And I'm Summer, and we are in love with all things Outlander. So, announcements this week. Our young Roger was cast this week.
Oui, Roger.
Yes, he is adorable. So his name is Rory Burns, and I'm sure it's pronounced very differently with a Scottish accent, but they have him all dressed up in little short pants and little brown shoes and a suit coat, little jacket. He's so cute, a little floppy hair. It was announced that Holland is going to be getting Outlander, which is good because, you know, Lotta is... almost said Hollandish.
Which is true. She is Hollandish, but she's also Dutch.
Thank you.
Not Danish, Dutch. And it's funny, it's not funny, but well, you could say NL for Netherlands, but whenever I see NL, I think...
New Zealand, is what I
No,
think.
Niederlande, which is Hollandish or Niederlandish, German coming through. But HBO Netherlands, which is pretty cool, which actually is like kind of funny because the HBO is not the network that has
No, I thought that was really kind of
interesting.
Ironic.
I wonder what, because we haven't done any research on this. I wonder what network has Game of Thrones. If HBO Netherlands has Game of Thrones in the Netherlands.
I mean, I have a feeling.
Cool.
I have a feeling that HBO keeps their shows throughout, but I don't think Stars is available.
Has its own network in every
correct
country yet.
I could be wrong. Stars, feel free to correct me on that. We also got word this week that the fans in New Zealand will also be getting Outlander on Lightbox.
Which If I read correctly, it's a new company or a new network. In whichever way it's formed, it's a new network. And so they don't even have a date yet. The Kiwis on Twitter and on Facebook went crazy town. They were so happy. And of course, we are too. Whenever we see any country getting it, we try and spread the word because it's just so exciting. But they're just... I had a friend, a Kiwi friend, say... I don't even care when it comes. It can be next... well, hopefully not next year. It can be next whatever. I'm just glad we have a network.
I know.
An announcement.
So we found out this week that Knockout Licensing will be representing...
Outlander merchandise.
Thank you. I don't know what's wrong with me today.
Me either.
But...
Is that rude?
Nope. They also do the licensing for Nashville, 50 Shades of Grey, Downton Abbey... and the Singer Company. So they do all the licensing
they do,
for sewing machines.
And what is it? Smithsonian Library Seed Catalog Collection. A very eclectic portfolio, no?
Oh, for sure. Oh, my daughter walked through the room earlier and she looked up at all the pictures on the screen and she goes, ooh, just in time. And I was like, what are you talking
and
about?
And I'm glad she didn't look up and say, ooh, 50 Shades. Because six-year-olds not
I mean, she can read.
She can read.
But
so
she
thankfully,
she
didn't
understand
go towards
it.
That. She wouldn't have understood it. But if she had read it.
Yeah, that would have been awkward.
That might have stuck in her ring. 50 Shades of what, Mommy?
She'll take that to school with her. I hope not.
Maybe with the month left, she would have forgotten it. But okay, onward and upward.
So as I'm sure everyone knows, episode 1 is currently available online. It's available on Stars Play. It's available on YouTube, if I'm not mistaken, as well. So at least everywhere in the United States can view it. I think that it's not available everywhere yet, but I think Canada did get a link that was workable.
They may have been, but we are only officially endorsing and sharing the ones that have come
from Stars. Of course, I'm just saying.
So a lot of people, we've read a lot of things about a lot of different things. And
just saying, yes. I have some friends in Canada who somehow were able to watch it. I don't know how, but they saw it.
Okay.
So if you're looking for it, there might be a link.
We don't
know
how, and we don't have a link for it.
And I'm not endorsing it.
Something we finally thought, we've talked about it on and off since pretty much almost for a year, but we finally saw our friend Sarah at Outlander TV News posted a pretty darn comprehensive and very gentle spoiler policy for their site, their pages.
And I like to say that we'll try to briefly discuss this, but Ginger's leading it, so it might be much longer than that.
I'm just going to hit the high notes or the main points. Basically, we've already said in... probably many, many, many times in different episodes that because we have a podcast, we will be discussing episodes in our podcast. We will not be doing breakdowns, and thankfully so. It's enough work to do a podcast. We don't need to do a huge blog post every week because it's Sarah even already posted her first review. Well, it's just so much work.
It is, and that's also like double work.
Well, it's double work because we already have to take notes. Don't get me wrong. We are taking notes just to be able to discuss it.
Sorry, I'm laughing because I'm pretty sure I was thinking Ginger's taking notes. I'm taking mental notes.
Well, I haven't taken notes yet, but we're going to get ready for that because we're recording that very soon. But our discussion of an episode will be a verbal discussion, just that. And it will
contain spoilers.
Oh, that's not even a question. Of course we're not going to dance around things. Oh, I know. Come on.
But if you tune into the podcast, you are there for the spoilers.
We hope that you've already watched it. So what our plan is the episode, our podcast episode airing closest to or the next day after the episode officially premieres on Stars. For example, episode 1 officially premieres on Saturday evening, August 9th. So our discussion of the first episode will air or will be posted Sunday, August 10th. And that is how we plan to, that's our method, that's our medium. However, for discussion of the episode, and someone hopefully listens to the podcast, we do encourage discussion of things that happened in the episode and earlier episodes. But specifically, discussion of episode 1 will hopefully take place in the comments of our post for episode 1. And this can be on Facebook as well. We will not be live tweeting and we will not be live Facebooking. We will not be sharing images or screen capping the episodes. Only official images provided to press and the public will be used. Sarah was very kind to allow us to basically kind of steal her spoiler policy. I put a lot of it in my own words, but the last half of it I did not. So basically, because it was so close to what we had wanted, and our discussion, instead of being a blog post prose style, will be in our discussion, in our episode. But we do encourage discussion.
We also speak in prose.
We do. That's true.
I don't speak in couplets.
No.
Or I am dyads.
Yeah. So we will have our episode post to our blog, and then, of course, the accompanying post on our Facebook page, and we'll pin it. And we encourage discussion, all of that, to that episode in the comments on Facebook and on the blog. Now, on the blog, comments are moderated, and we get to them as soon as we can. But on Facebook, the only quote-unquote moderation that's automatically done is a language filter for foul language, however you want to put it. I think it's on mild or something. I don't even know. But pretty much any comment will come through. And if we see something, though, that is a spoiler of thinking about what's going to happen in a future episode, it will be deleted without warning. Because we're trying to respect not just people who haven't read, but also other countries who don't have the ability to access this yet. And so that's pretty much our spoiler policy. That's it. And also our final little note is, if you want to stay completely spoiler-free, as Sarah says, please stay off social media. It's the truth.
But it's a given. That's the only way. The only way to stay spoiler-free is to turn your phone off, don't leave your house, and stay in a dark room for a week.
Okay, no, that's not what I said, but pretty much. So also, as Sarah says, questions, comments, or suggested changes to this policy are welcome. It is developing. We're doing our best right now, not having started the series officially, but if something comes up, this could definitely change. So go ahead and visit that page every once in a while.
I know. And technically, we could have started our recaps this week since the episode was up.
I know.
We've had this interview, like, burning in our back pocket for, like, 2 weeks.
I'm thinking Diana, like, finally is giving up on us. Like, they're never going to post this. Like, Diana, this is your week. Well, every week is Diana's week. But
Indirectly.
Yeah. But this is a very special thing for us. Probably one of, yes, having Davina was awesome and we look forward to, you know, other possibilities in the future, including more of Diana if we're lucky enough. But this is something we've been trying for months and months and months and months to get, and we're so happy to have had the opportunity and to finally be able to share it with you.
Though I do want to point out that it did take months and months and months to make it happen, but she agreed to do it instantly. Like, we asked her, and she was like, instantaneously, like, yeah, let's do it.
The scheduling, we were trying to fit it around her Sacramento visit.
Right.
Because that's somewhat close to us. And with the change of the date from, was it? It was first the fall.
No, first the fall. Really? I thought it was March.
Maybe it was March. But first from the spring, it was in the spring and then moved to June. So we thought, oh, we're contacting her plenty early, which we were, but plenty extra early because, so we were on the ball, we think, a little bit, trying to get things rolling. And she said yes quite early and we were just tickled at that. But just getting it scheduled, it was fine. It wasn't a problem. It was just, her schedule, as you can only imagine, is so packed.
Full.
During this time period. And this was like on her, bless her heart, this was like on her, one of her last nights of freedom before she had to go back on the, back on tour, I think. True.
Now, just to backtrack, I know I jumped into that interview discussion. However, we had one more bit of announcements. And this week, as you may have noticed, we updated our cover photo for all of our sites. We did this because with all of the new graphics we've been getting, we thought maybe it was time to have our logo be a little more, you know,
show, reflective show, of the show.
Reflective and show specific.
So the one that we had before, again, was of an image that I took while living in Scotland. I took a picture of the city of Inverness at night while going for a walk along the river. And I don't even think I named it. It was just a photo. And then I sent some friends and family. And when I came home for a Christmas visit, I had a painting waiting for me in this kind of Monet-ish impressionistic style from summer. And it was of the photo that I had shared with family and friends. And then, since it was now a painting, she named it, because I was not doing it for any kind of art's sake, and hers was beautiful. She named it Inverness by Night, because that was literally what it was. And so, it was fine, and I still like it, but I think we want to kind of, you know, and then I think the theme here is, well, if we get some subsequent seasons, I think we might
could
change it.
We could update it, you know, with each season. However, I really wanted to do something that was more specific to the show.
Yeah, absolutely.
I love the Inverness by Night.
No, I do.
Picture, but it was like almost like a placeholder, if you will. It's kind of like we didn't have anything else. What can we put in there for a logo?
What can we put in there that we own that we won't have any copyright problems with?
Right.
Because we looked and we thought, well, there's a lot of pretty stuff out there, but we don't have the money to buy anything that's gorgeous that we would have liked. And I thought, you know what? Actually, you thought of it, right? You thought of this and you thought, you know, we have this. Go take a picture. And I said, okay, done.
But actually, I was really pleasantly surprised with how the new picture turned out. It was very stressful for me, and I was really,
it was stressful for you.
It was.
Yeah,
I was
when you were painting it.
Yes, it was just
so
much
seriously?
Pressure on me.
Well, kind of, yeah, but summer it was like less than 2 hours.
I didn't want to mess.
You, like,
it up.
You like popped it out, and I don't know.
I just didn't want to mess it up.
Well, of course not, because she even said, you know, the first one maybe just a draft, a first iteration of it, which is still pretty, but it may not, if you're not happy with it, you may not want to share it.
Well,
and the first one looked really nice.
What's really funny is I always sketch them out before I paint. I sketch on the canvas, and Ginger goes, well, before you start painting, I want to come and look at the sketch. And I was like, okay, I don't think she realizes what my sketches look like.
And I don't.
So she comes out, and it's just like lines on the paper, and she's like, wait, so that, what? I have no idea what that is.
I'm like, where's the tree? She's like, here. I'm like, oh, well, where's the ground, the mountain, or whatever? Oh, right here. Okay, where's the sun going to come through? Oh, right here. Where's the stones? Right. I literally was asking about every shape on there. So I'm like, yeah, it's just meaningless to me.
Just let me paint it. Anyway, it's one of the things I like about acrylics, though, is that they dry so fast. But because they dry so fast, you can't really get it done. Well, you can go over it and paint over it, but then you've literally got to, like, repaint it. Because you can't re-wet the paints. They don't. It's not like oils where they stay wet for days. But yay, I hope you all like it. I had a good time painting it once I got over the stress of it.
So now you have a year off at least.
Now I have a year off. Oh, but I want you to know that almost immediately Ginger was trying to give it away.
I just
painted it. This is the first painting I've ever done that I'm like planning on keeping for myself. And she's like, oh, we could do this. And I was like, no, we can't. Stop giving my stuff away.
Okay, so.
Typical.
I'm never giving your stuff away. But I'm happy with it. She's happy with it. We hope you enjoy it. It is a selfish thing. It's for us to have a little bit of a change up. And I was telling Summer, whenever I bring up my phone, kind of not so much on the internet because it's a much bigger visual space, but on my phone when I bring up Twitter and I look at something and I go, oh my gosh, what the heck? Because I'm so not used to this. It's much lighter. Mm-hmm. The other one was heavier and darker blues and blacks. And this is so much lighter. And so I'm still getting used to it. So when I see it on my phone, I'm like, oh my gosh, what happened to our thing? Who's messing with our account?
And
me. I uploaded it. But yeah, so if you see one of our old ones floating about, give us a contact because I tried to replace it everywhere. But the one on Audioboo will take a little bit longer. We have someone helping us on our host to end with that. So
yeah, enough of that. Back to the important part. So without any further ado, our interview with Dr. Gabaldon.
Hi, Dr. Gabaldon.
Yes, hi.
Okay, yeah. Wonderful. We have you. Thank you. Thank you so much for your patience.
Oh, no problem at all.
It's entirely on our side. Thank you so much for bearing with us. So first of all, thank you so much for agreeing to speak with us.
Sure. Absolutely.
We know you've had a very busy, probably the last month at least, with all the traveling you've been doing. And
yeah,
all the signing.
Yeah, book tour season is usually kind of a new.
And it's about a year, right?
Let's see. Well, and I finished writing Written in My Own Heart's Blood on April 15th, having stayed up for 36 hours straight to do so. And then I spent the next 10 days doing the copy edits and the galley proofing concurrently. It's a long book, so it was sort of in rolling sections. And then my husband took me to Disneyland for 3 days to recover from this, after which I spent most of May, tidying up all the things that had been ruthlessly shoved out of the way while I finished the book over the preceding 6 months. And come June, book tour season was upon us. So I've been out since June 7th, pretty much, with just very brief touchdowns at home. This is one of them. I'm going back to Seattle tomorrow.
Oh, my goodness. I think I've heard you say before that once a book tour starts, it's kind of basically a year of your life.
Well, it's not that so much. What I said was that over the 5 years or so between books, it takes me actually about 3.5 years to write the book with the research and everything else. And then there's about another year's worth of promotion, but that's not all book tour. It's spread out all over the time, because when you're fortunate enough to have a popular book or series of books, people kind of want to look at you all the time. And so, I'm sort of constantly invited to go to festivals and writers' conferences and do events and do speaking and all that. And in fact, I refuse, 7/8 of the invitations I get, or I'd never be home. But there's what you might call a lot of demand. Though the book touring kind of, it's country dependent. So when the book comes out, it comes out in English. And so there's sort of immediate demand from the U.S. and Canada, who kind of have dibs, I being an American and a North American. And we can kind of combine the Canadian with the U.S., because going across the border is not all that difficult. So we are almost at the end of that jag. But then I will be going to the U.K. in mid-August, entering the Edinburgh Book Festival. And so the U.K. editor and publisher is building a small book tour around that. And I'm not going to Australia and New Zealand immediately. I'm going in April. And we don't know about Germany. They wanted me to come, but not until they've made a deal for the German distribution of the TV show, so that they can kind of do two for one and promote the German translation of the book along with promotion of the TV show. So they are likely to pop up in my mid somewhere around November and say, oh, by the way, can you come next week?
We understand you are in very much in demand, and that's why we're so tickled.
Well, I'm really pleased that we made contact. Yeah, my husband is inclined not to answer the phone unless he recognizes whoever is calling.
That's very fair. We had the good fortune of being at your Sacramento book signing.
Oh, how nice.
And where you so eloquently described the shapes of a few of your novels.
Yeah.
And we know you've done this before, but we thought it was very fascinating. Would you describe the shapes of your novels for our listeners?
Sure. Let's see. The first one is fairly simple. It was my first book and so forth. And its interior shape is of three overlapping pyramids or triangles. In other words, it's got three climaxes to its action. And the first is when Jamie returns Claire to the stone circle. He's found out what she is and, tells her to go back to Frank and to safety and to her life. And then she is faced with this moment of decision. Is she going back to Frank, whom she sincerely loves, or is she going to stay with Jamie, whom she also very sincerely loves? And so she makes her choice, and that's the first climax, or the tip of the first triangle. All of the action is leading up to that, and then there's this cataclysmic moment. Well, then the action declines slightly. They go to Lallybroch, and you have this peaceful domestic interlude. Action then comes up sharply again when Jamie is captured, and the second climax is when Claire saves him from being hanged at Wentworth Prison. On the other hand, she can't save him from the psychological damage that he suffered. She can mend some of the physical damage, but the damage to his spirit is much more difficult. And then there's this, you know, sort of slide into his depression and so forth. And so this is the third peak of the story, of the third climax, is when she manages to save his soul at the Abbey in France. And then we come down to a satisfying ending. So that book is, as I say, a triple triangle, which is, you know, intuitively satisfying as a shape. Dragonfly in Amber is a little more complicated. It's my second book, and I knew a little more. This one has a framing story on either end, and it's shaped like a dumbbell. The framing story would be the nut at either end that's holding the weights onto the bar. And that framing story has a double viewpoint. It has Claire's first-person viewpoint, which is the one that I used all the way through Outlander. But it also has a third-person viewpoint from Roger Wakefield, the young historian that Claire comes to for help in finding out what happened. And we don't know why what happened, but we are very eager to find out. And we then drop in to Claire's narrative voice for the bulk of the book, which is essentially a gigantic extended flashback that tells you what happened, you know, after the end of Outlander. And the first weight is sort of a curve. It's an arc of action, and this takes place in France, dealing with the Jacobite plots that were going on there and the political stuff, you know, why Louis and the other Bourbon monarchs were, or in some cases were not, interested in supporting a Stuart rising, you know, what the Scots were doing about it. But it's, it takes place mostly in Paris, some in the French countryside. And as I say, it is a rising curve. It comes down then when they think they have achieved their aim of preventing the rising, and they go back to Scotland and to Lallybroch. And there's a, you know, long, you know, fairly quiet domestic interlude, which is the bar in the middle of the story. And then the second arc is what happens when they discover that they have not succeeded and the rising is upon them. And then we have this arc that deals with the three battles of the rising and the disaster at Culloden. And then finally there is the second half of the framing story, which contains a, you know, a twist and a final cliffhanger that caused people to send me death threats when that book was published. Well, not serious ones, but yeah, they were very upset. And so they were sort of strongly anticipating Voyager. And now Voyager has a very interesting narrative structure. I call it a horse tail. And that's because the first third of the book is done with a triple narrative that's kind of braided. We open with Jamie Fraser thinking he's dead on the field at Culloden and realizing in horror and despair that he's not. And we then take Jamie's story going forward from that point. Back in the future, we have Claire's viewpoint, and she is recollecting her past, you know, few years separated from Jamie and what happened then. So she's looking back. So we have one story moving forward and one story moving back, essentially. And between them, we have Roger Wakefield, the historian, and he is doing historical detective work to try to find Jamie Fraser in history and see what did happen to him. And, you know, did he survive? If he did, how long? And, you know, where might he be? You know, now being defined as someplace Claire could reach him. And so and he's the turning point between Jamie's and Claire's story. And of course, there's this subtext of the burgeoning love affair between him and Claire and Jamie's daughter, Brianna. So that braided narrative takes up the first third of the book. And then when Claire goes back through time, it falls into sort of a linear narrative, though with multiple strands, but it's all Claire's voice at that point, so that's why it's shaped like a horsetail. Drums of Autumn is next. That one is an interesting one. It has it's shaped like a rose with one big efflorescence and a couple of side buds or smaller things. It has sort of the main arc of the story is just a regular branching arc of you know, immigration and settlement, you know, Claire and Jamie going to the New World and, you know, attempting to start a new life there and the formation of their community and at the same time sort of the drumbeat of a very distant war, because they were still, you know, 10 years before the revolution at this point, but you can hear it coming. And there's the small bits that involve their relations with the Native Americans that they live amongst and with the other Scottish settlers, as well as Jamie's relations with his Scottish kin who are settled nearby. The side buds and so forth have to do with their daughter, Brianna, who comes back, you know, to find them And so there's this little burst when she arrives. And then the other one is when Jamie, under the misapprehension that the man standing in front of him and demanding to know where his daughter is the man who raped her, beats the man up and gives him to the Indians, only to discover that this is Roger, who has followed Brianna and is definitely not a rapist, but in fact her intended. And so that's the second and larger flower. And then at the end, there's this major efflorescence where all the plot lines kind of burst into spectacular color. And let's see what comes next. Fiery Cross. Okay, Fiery Cross is a really interesting one. It has what is described by some readers as the longest day ever, in that about the first quarter of the book takes place in one day during a gathering on a mountain in North Carolina. But during that one day is where the seeds of every single plot line in the book begin. That's where they're all planted. Now, all of these seeds then actually sprout into what you might consider the arcs of a rainbow, and they arc through the book, but they come down at different points. So you sort of have this interesting spray united at one end and this rooted in this day, and then, you know, going bing, 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 one after another, and they run parallel. But as I say, they will terminate at different points. So there's one really long-running arc that brings you down at the very end when sort of everybody is reunited, and this book is a lot to do with clan and community and revolution, because this book is the one that deals with the Battle of Alamance and the War of the Regulation, which in some ways was a mini rehearsal for the American Revolution. It was a genuine taxpayers' revolt, and it was also the site of the very last Highland Charge anywhere ever. Was rather a tragic thing. But anyway, it's an interesting book, but that's got, as I say, a rainbow structure. Then we come to A Breath of Snow and Ashes. Now, Fiery Cross and Breath of Snow and Ashes are both the same length. Each one of them is 508,000 words, which, as I told my editor when I turned in Fiery Cross, said it's exactly the same size as Shogun. Which is true. But those are my two longest books, and I promised my foreign rights agent, who nearly had a heart attack when I told him how long they were, that I would endeavor to make the next one not quite that long. So anyway, Breath of Snow and Ashes, do you know that Japanese print called The Great Wave off Kagawa? It's yes. It's blue and white, and it's basically a tsunami wave with sort of curling fingers, and it's about to come down on a number of small fishing boats. And in the background is Mount Fuji as a single fixed point of reference. It's a very striking print. But anyway, when I was talking to my UK editor, and I said, well, I've finally seen the shape of this book, so it looks like The Great Wave off Kagawa, but there's two of them. So it does. It's actually in two parts, each of which comes to a tremendous climax and then sort of falls into, you know, foam and rush and turbulence and so forth. The final wave, though, falls into foam and rush and turbulence, but then smooths out into calm water at the very end. Now, that particular book caused people to write to me in droves and say, oh, we're so sad, the series is over, what will we do without Janie and Claire? Which caused me to say, what makes you think it's the last book? Did I say it's the end? No. And they all wrote back and said, well, but you wrapped everything up so neatly, we thought it must be the end. Which I replied, see if I ever do that again. And so, consequently, an echo in the bone is different. Now,
and then Sam suffers for it.
Yes, indeed. Yeah, well, an echo in the bone. The cover illustration is a caltrop, and that's actually fairly close to the structure of the book. The book has four main plot lines, all of which, you know, come together in the nexus of the American Revolution, which is now actually in full roar. And it ends if I may say so, a brilliantly conceived and beautifully executed triple cliffhanger. the four stories, I closed one of them, and I did close it at the end, so they did get a satisfactory ending. But we did leave the other three sort of, well, definitely hanging, which caused a lot more screaming and carrying on, so I told them it was all their own fault. Let's see, which brings us up to the new book written in my own heart's blood. Well, the cover illustration on this is, you may not recognize it immediately by looking at it, but what it is an octothorpe, otherwise known as the lowly hash mark. And this is a very beautiful calligraphic octothorpe, which I found online. I wanted an octopus on the cover to start with because it is the eighth book. There are eight major viewpoint characters, and there are eight storylines, though the storylines do, in fact, merge and overlap with each other. They aren't entirely separate. So it's not quite such a tangle as it may sound like. And in fact, all the storylines are connected, just as the arms of an octopus are at the body. Yeah, anyway, I told the publisher that I wanted an octopus on the cover. Now you can kind of tell when a publisher does not really like your ideas, but is reluctant to tell you so. Just kind of pronounce silence on the other end of the line. And then they start sending you the art department's extremely feeble attempts at what you described, and usually these are so horrible that you give up and say, no, do whatever you want. In this case, I didn't, but I said, well, this octopus is obviously not going to work, and my husband said, well, can you think outside the box? What else is eight? And I was thinking octo. I thought octothorpe, because it's always been one of my favorite words. It's just very elegant. And so I said, well, maybe octothorpe. Let's see what we can do with that. And so I went online. The very first thing that popped up when I Googled octothorpe was this very beautiful shape done by a type designer named Conrad Altman. And I said, that's great. That's beautiful. And not only is it very visually striking, but the calligraphy makes it look as though there are two infinity signs involved in it. And also that there's a Möbius curve going on, which is entirely appropriate given all the time travel that goes on in that book. And so I said, great, octothorpe. And the publisher was so relieved to have, you know, images that they could take and use that they got enlivened. And they came up with the idea of putting it in a blob of sealing wax and then designing the cover so that it looked somewhat like a folded letter in the 18th century style, which would just have been folded and sealed with wax, they not really having envelopes as such at the time. And so that's where that one came from. The story inside is very much the same way. It it does look like an octothorpe, and you are following one plot line, and suddenly you run into another with no sense of shock. It just, you know, changes gradually around you. And as you switch back and forth following that curved line, you pick up one character and then another. And the whole thing is, you know, embedded in this, you know, bloody matrix of the war that's going on around them. So anyway, that's what they all look like.
It's fascinating. Yay. Oh, my goodness. Thank you so much for that.
Oh, you're more than welcome. I don't know how interested people would be in that, but that's what it looked like to me.
You would be surprised, because I think that you had everyone in the palm of your hand. Just like, I know everyone was there to see you anyway, but I think when you started talking about the shape, everyone just leaned forward in their chair a little bit and listened a lot closer.
Well, that's very nice.
So I know that you don't write with an outline or in a straight line in any way, shape, or form. So how do you know when you've reached the end of your book?
Oh, because the shape is complete. You know, I will have seen the shape sometime before I actually end the book. As I write, all the little bits and pieces gradually begin to stick together. As I said, maybe a tecramento, it's like playing Tetris in my head, but very slowly. So all these jagged shapes are fitting into each other and making larger shapes. Well, I do the research at the same time as the writing, and so I will be, you know, picking up things out of the research that I can use as sort of a rough historical timeline. So for instance, I'm saying, well, what happened in 1778 during me? And I have this very useful book called The Almanac of the American Revolution. Tells you what was going on, you know, everywhere on each date where anything recorded happened. It's brief, but it's very enlightening. And so you're reading along and you're thinking, well, I could use this. This sounds interesting, but I can't use it because the characters are nowhere near there and I don't see any reasonable way of getting them there, so I'll have to pass on that one. But I could use this. And that's how the Battle of Monmouth came to be sort of the centerpiece of this particular book. That was the only huge battle that was taking place in the time period that I was dealing with, and it was fairly near where my people were at the time. So it was fairly reasonable for them to take part. And it was also a really good metaphor for the state of things at that point. Battle of Monmouth was the longest battle in the American Revolution. It lasted from before dawn till after dark, and it was fought in July, so, you know, fairly much in the long part of summer. And more people died on the field of heat stroke than of battle wounds. It was a very hot day. But the most important thing about it was not that the Americans won, but that they didn't lose. This was the first battle fought by George Washington's troops when they came out of Valley Forge. Because General Clinton, who had been occupying Philadelphia, realized that Washington was about to come out and wisely decided to decamp. So he evacuated from Philadelphia, taking with him several thousand British loyalists who were afraid to stay in the city and be overtaken by the Patriots. And so he was making speed out of Philadelphia, headed for New York with three bodies of armed men, his own Lord Cornwallis's division, and a gang of Hessian mercenaries under General von Neithausen. Anyway, they were all, you know, roaring up the road and widely separated. Their baggage train ran 12 miles, so it was rather vulnerable. They needed to make speed. And Washington, of course, was hot on their heels because he was determined to engage with them if he possibly could. He needed to prove to everyone, including his new French allies, but most importantly to the men themselves, that they could stand up against the might of a trained British army. So they were making all haste as they could. Consequently, the battle was not the sort that you usually find in the 18th century. Normally, they would have sort of chosen their ground, and the armies would have faced off, and you would have had this rather old-fashioned sort where you had the British, you know, aiming in volleys, and to some extent the Americans as well, because that was just, you know, the customary type of warfare. In this instance, they couldn't do that, and Clinton was forced to choose the best ground he could. Well, the ground where the Battle of Monmouth was fought is very choppy. It's rolling terrain, it's farmland, and it's crisscrossed by ravines because there are several creeks in the area. Consequently, the landscape kind of folds in and out. When you're in a ravine, everything is completely hidden. There were thick growth of trees, but then there was cleared meadows and farmland. And so there just wasn't any, you know, clear ground on which to fight a classic battle. Consequently, the whole thing ended up being a mishmash of little tiny groups, you know, fighting vicious battles, but it was just vicious pitched battles. You know, there was no real order to it, with, you know, some exceptions like the artillery in the cider orchard, which, you know, was doing what artillery should do, just standing there and, you know, crushing everything that came toward it. But most of it was, as I say, more or less hand-to-hand combat, and you know, very, very messy by 18th century standards. Nobody on the field had any idea what was going on for the most part, and even once the battle was over, it was, you know, months, if not years, before people figured out enough to, you know, declare. They didn't ever declare one side the victor because there was no victor. Clinton escaped, which by his terms was victory, but Washington's troops acquitted themselves very well, and they weren't beat. That was victory by their point of view. So anyway, very, very interesting battle. But so that's how it ended up, as kind of what you might call the military backbone. Anyway, returning to what I was actually saying, there's a reason why I write long books. As I said, I like digressions. But anyway, I'm generating this historical timeline in the back of my head. And at some point, I will have enough of those large chunks that I can sort of try putting them up against that timeline. And I'll say, well, you know, this chunk has to go over here because it happened just before the battle, whereas this chunk, you know, obviously had to have happened after the battle, and these two I'm not sure about, but maybe they go here. Anyway, by the time I've got five or six chunks lined up in this way, I can just kind of step back and look at it, and if we're all lucky, I will see the shape of the book at that point. Now, the shape of the book that's guiding me, not the one that's visible to the readers, which would be the Octothorpe I described, but the one that I saw when I was looking at this book and set it up against my time, looks like a chord progression. And I don't know if you ever played the piano or whatever, but you know, you start with a major chord, and then you extend it, and then you come back, and then you do what's called a diminished seventh, and then back to the resolution, which is your bass chord. That's how it works. That Battle of Monmouth, the three parts in the middle are essentially one very large part. So it essentially has five sections. And sections 1, 3, and 5 are essentially what happens in the 18th century, whereas 2 and 4 are what happen in the 20th century, which have their own plot, and that's a plot that may or may not come back in the next book. I don't plan the next book in any, well, I don't plan it at all, but, you know, still I can see things that I've kind of left over from this book. So we need to know what happens to Lord John. We need to know where William is going next. And we would really like to know what about those people who were trying to kill Brianna in the 20th century, and what did her father Frank know when he took such pains to equip her for life in the 18th century.
Yeah, that was definitely a new angle that came in with the 20th century spy games, as it were.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, you know, when you start thinking about time travel and so forth, you get all kinds of interesting possibilities. The other thing that happens, people say, well, you know, the TV show, is this affecting your writing at all? Do you envision the actors instead of the people in your head? And I don't at all. You know, they're completely separate. It's a wonderful show, by the way. I think everyone will enjoy it. But it did cause me to think more about Frank, partly because when we were talking it over to start with, Ron Moore was telling his ideas on adaptation while asking me about characters and storylines, and did I have have, you know, any additional material that might be useful to them. And one of the things I told him was, I said, well, there's more to Frank than you see in the books. He was a spy during World War II. He's a man who keeps secrets. And I said, I know some of his secrets, but not a lot of them. Anyway, I gave him a copy of the short story called A Leaf on the Wind of All Hallows, which has to do with Roger McKenzie's parents, but Frank is in it as the man who recruits Jerry McKenzie and sends him on, you know, what is probably a suicide mission, not, you know, wanting to get rid of him just because this was a thing that had to be done. And so this is, it kind of shows you a side of Frank that you don't see in the other books. Anyway, that to that question, as well as that story, kind of padded more Frank, you might say, or more thoughts of Frank. And in fact, as Ron has been working on the show and so forth, there is more of Frank in the show than there is in the book Outlander. That is, we see what he was doing when Claire disappeared, which of course we don't see in the book because Claire wasn't there to see it. But that, you know, just has me to think more about him. And as I was doing that, that's where some of the stuff in those modern parts of written in My Own Heart's Blood came from.
Speaking of Frank, do you think that in the course of the series, the Star series, or in your books, that we'll ever see a flashback of Claire and Frank's first meeting?
You might. Yeah, I wouldn't be surprised, but I don't know. Now, somewhere in the fullness of time, I can sense that there's a small book out there called What Frank Knew, but I'm not sure, and that will be from Frank's point of view. But he's not talking to me as yet. There's just this hint. He's kind of aware of me, you might say, but he's not ready to talk.
So the gifts that Mandy and Jem have, the sensing of each other and visiting their grandfather in their dreams,
mm-hmm.
is this associated with the time travel gene or with the Fraser line? Because we know Jamie also, of course, sees them in his dreams, and Jenny saw Claire's apparition at Lyra's wedding.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, there's sort of this strong Celtic gift of the sight. So there's probably some of that. But as to Jimmy and Mandy's ability to sense each other, I think that's probably to do with the time travel gene.
Do you imagine the Brian Ellen prequel that you've spoken of will mm-hmm. be like a big book or more of a novella?
I probably won't know until I get fully into it. It's kind of got the potential to be a big book. It might not be, you know, quite as large as the biggest of my books, but, you know, it could be pretty substantial. It could be at least the size of Brotherhood of the Blade, which is 150,000 words. So as a Scottish Prisoner, I think it's 180. So, you know, it's a nice substantial book, not a little one.
So I don't ever want to think about you not writing anything in the Outlander landscape, but if the day comes when there is no more Outlander stories, do you think that you have other stories to write, maybe in a different landscape?
Oh, I do, yeah. I actually have a contract for two contemporary crime novels, which I originally was going to write mysteries, and then I said, no, mysteries have plots. I don't know if I can do that. And so wrote historical fiction on the theory that it would be easier. Yeah, well, as I say, I originally was going to write a mystery, and then other things happened, and they gave me a three-book contract when we sold Outlander. Well, as I finished Voyager, I said to my agent, well, you know, there actually is still more to the story. There is a fourth book. And he said, well, they'll be glad to hear that, since Voyager had hit the New York Times list, and the whole series was doing very well. And I said, good. I said, well, tell them that they can have the fourth book, but only if they will give me a contract to write a mystery as well, because I was well aware that publishers don't like you to stop doing something that's selling and do something else. And so I said, this may be our only chance to blackmail them into it. And so they thought about it and, you know, gracefully submitted. And I said, well, yes, okay, we'll give you a contract to write two mysteries. And then if the first one is successful, we'll have the basis of a new series. So they, you know, did not pay me a huge advance or anything. It was quite modest, but still, I have a contract for those two books. And in fact, the Germans also bought those two books for substantially more money and are kind of breathing down my neck about them. They underwent a regime change a couple of years ago, and it occurred to the new regime to actually look at their contracts and see what kind of books they had outstanding. They were going, wait a minute. So anyway, the first of those is about half done, and it's kind of hovering toward the top of my pile. But, you know, I routinely work on multiple projects at once until one gets, you know, well past critical mass, and then I'll pretty much drop everything else and concentrate on that. So I'll probably come back to the contemporary crime novel fairly soon here. Now, we also have Master Raymond, who you'll remember from Dragonfly and Amber. He's very interesting. We see him briefly again. Novella called us The Space Between. But I know who he is, where he came from, and something about his life. And so he'll get his own book eventually. It may be more than one. But
I will buy every single one of them.
In all. Oh no, we do.
We love Mastering.
Hardback, trade paperback, favorites. Ebook, and audio.
The ideal reader.
Oh, you could say that. Well, I will counter with you are the ideal author. So. So in Outlander, you mentioned that Claire and the men are, quote, in the upper room at the inn while they are beginning to plan Jamie's rescue from Wentworth.
Mm-hmm.
The date is December 21st. Mm-hmm. It's approximately 40 days after Claire and Jamie are at the Stones on her birthday, October 29th,
mm-hmm.
when she decides to remain with Jamie.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
This timing and the words the upper room were very evocative of Mary and the disciples in hiding in fear before Pentecost.
Wasn't it?
Was this planned or a happy coincidence, or am I reading too deeply?
Well, you're the first one who's ever seen that, but no, it wasn't a coincidence.
Oh, wow. Sorry, I'm so shocked at you. I couldn't even, I don't know what to say. Okay, Summer, go ahead. We're so tickled.
So how would you say your day-to-day life has changed since the announcement of the Star series? Or has it?
Well, let's see. Slightly in that, occasionally the Stars people will call upon me to go and do something, interesting and peculiar. We did a fan event in January, for 2,500 fans in Los Angeles at a nice old restored theater. And, Ron Moore and, Sam Heughan and Katrina Balfe came and we did a panel for them and showed them trailers and so forth. And it was great fun. Everybody had a wonderful time. But that's something that I had not done myself, just, in the course of the events. And then they asked me to go and do the Television Critics Association thing in Los Angeles. This is basically 3 or 4 days where you spend all day pretty much doing short interviews with different journalists and bloggers and websites and things. But you also will do a sort of a formal presentation to the assembled television critics who are there, which is about 200 people. And so there were all four of us at this presentation, and Ron showed them a very evocative action-filled trailer with, thundering drums and so forth, which got them all awake. And when we were waiting to go in, we were told by some of the other casts and so forth who had done this before, they said, now don't be bothered, if you're not getting any reaction from the audience, because they're all so busy typing, and blogging and, sending things out as you say them, that they don't even look up, And we were watching on the monitor the people from Da Vinci's Demons who were before us, and sure enough, they weren't getting any response at all from their audience. They were just, answering the moderator's questions, and it was, basically a dead room. It was depressing. But anyway, I said to Ron, I said, I bet we can wake them up. And we did.
I have to ask this, and you are, of course, at liberty to answer or not.
Mm-hmm.
Do you know what age Jamie's ghost was, or the ghost was, in Outlander?
Oh, yes, I did, as a matter of fact. Sam Heughan asked me, and I hadn't thought about it before, but I just answered him immediately. Do you want to know?
Yes, of course.
He's about 25.
Okay. Very, very interesting. And I think we have one last question, since you've just been so patient with us. Has there been a character that you wish you hadn't killed, or not hadn't killed, but didn't have to kill?
Oh, Well, there's a number of people whose deaths I regret extremely. It's very upsetting. I was deeply shattered when Rupert died, and certainly at losing Murtaugh, that was, a deep wound. And, in the most recent book, maybe I should not mention out loud who died, not wishing to, spoil anything, should you be broadcasting mm-hmm. to people who are stupid enough to listen without having read the book. But that was very upsetting, too.
We definitely are putting spoiler alerts everywhere before this episode goes out, but there were several deaths in this book that had us screaming in my house.
Oh, yeah. Uh-huh. No, it was very upsetting.
And not only of the human persuasion.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
The animal persuasion.
And also, on happier notes, there were, without giving spoilers, obviously, the end was blissfully joyful, and I cried out of tears of joy. I couldn't stop. And, of course, with a certain kind of quote-unquote homecoming as it were, of a certain type between a certain woman and a certain...
Oh, my God, you're just dancing around.
I'm sorry. I don't want to say it, but I
No, don't say it. You're screaming and so forth.
Let me just say, when there was a goodbye a few books ago, I was sad. I'm just so happy to see the hello.
Oh, yeah, of course. Well, as I told people about the last book, I said I firmly expected to leave everyone in floods of tears, but feeling totally happy. So, yeah, this is like... kind of ending. This is not the last book, by the way, but the last book will, you know, leave people with a similar emotion. I'm not sure how we're going to get there, but it's just a feeling.
Well, honestly, as long as there's not, like, a six-year-old boy trapped in a dark mine for 5 years.
I don't think that'll happen again.
I think we're happy with the ending.
Yeah, no, I don't like to do things that I've done before, so I can pretty much assure you that one. I'll think of something else.
Okay, I lied. One more question, and I promise you we will let you go, because it just came to my mind. I won't give a spoiler, but in the future books, will it be explained how
the ending
people...
came about?
Yes.
Yeah, yeah, we will.
Okay, perfect. That's all I wanted to know.
Well, that's great.
Ms. I'll just stick to doctor, because that's safe. Dr. Gabaldon, it has been our... amazing, tremendous pleasure, and we're tickled beyond belief, and thank you so much for spending some of your last night of freedom again with us.
No problem at all. No, you've been a joy to talk to. Yeah.
Oh, thank. To use a Jamie term, don't give me flutterbys.
Yeah. I should maybe mention, you know, in regard to the upper room thing and so forth. You have probably seen this, but Outlander is in fact a Christ allegory, which I always expect someone to have noticed by the time Randall nailed his hand to the table. But people are not as religious as they used to be, I think. So most people don't even notice that.
Oh no, I have heard you say that, but absolutely, sometimes when we've done our read along on our podcast of either chapter by chapter or sometimes out of necessity, a 2-chapter chunk, I admit I probably read sometimes too much into things. That's why I wanted to ask about the Pentecost.
your symbology is very good.
No, and you should have heard her when she went off on trees. Like one week there was something about, was it an aspen tree?
I don't know, but you had mentioned so many trees, and the one tree that Jamie sat under was an oak.
Yeah.
And I thought he could have sat under a few different trees, and this is the one where he was sitting and holding Claire, or she was in his lap, or something to that effect. And I just look at all the trees that you used.
found one that meant something, and then from then on out, every week we had to stop her. Every week was like, well, I looked up this tree, and this tree means, and we're like, oh, okay.
Yeah, no, trees have lots of meaning. You know?
Yes, they do.
Yeah, if you've ever done runes, there's a whole tree, I wouldn't call it a mythology exactly, but tree symbolism that goes with the reading of runes.
Oh, yes, and the Celtic, the months, are, the 13 months are named after trees?
Yes, exactly.
Yes, it's very, as you can tell, at least myself, I am loquacious as well, so I understand. So thank you. It's been a joy and a pleasure, and I know we've gone over time, and we do respect your private time, and we wanted to say...
Oh, but I did want to put one more thing out there. I have a friend who, thanks to your use of the word absquatulate, there is now a band in Arkansas called Absquatulate.
Really?
It's supposed to be a cover band right now, but he cracked me up when he told me that because I introduced him to the books when he had some spare time on his hands.
Ah, I see. Okay. Well, I'm extremely flattered, and I would love to listen to some of their music.
Oh, she will make sure that they know.
I will find some for you.
Well, thank you so much, Dr. Gabaldon, and we hope in the years to come that, especially with a new book, but who knows, that we may have such an opportunity again.
Oh, I hope so, yeah. Yeah, whenever you have your podcast, you know, ready for human consumption, yeah, send me the link and I'll tweet it or Facebook it or whatever.
Absolutely, you got it.
You got it, and we'll very gently hold you to that. Okay, well, thank you so much, and have a great rest of your evening. Rest up, and God bless.
Thank you. Okay, you too.
Thanks so much. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
So I know it was like 10 minutes ago, but can we please take a moment to reflect on the fact that Ginger was speechless for like a good 3 seconds?
Minutes ago. That was funny. I even thought about editing that out because I'm like, oh, it's flat space, flat line. It's silence. And then when I was, but then I actually listened to the whole thing and I thought, oh no, that's funny.
Like she stood and talked face-to-face with Tobias Menzies and all the other actors and was fine and not speechless whatsoever, but one conversation with Diana and she's like, bruh.
No, I wasn't speechless with Diana. It was one question that she answered that left me speechless. And if you've listened, you've heard.
If they got to this, they heard.
That's what I said. If you've listened, you've heard. But there's a reason I was speechless because I couldn't... just dumbfounded. Right. Like right now. I was just dumbfounded. You could have knocked me over with a feather. I mean, it was pretty... I had nothing forming in my mind at that time.
She thought for sure there was going to be like a follow-up statement to it. And she was just like, well, yes.
And I thought, well, okay. I was fully prepared for her to say, nope, that's nice. But no, you read a lot into it. And yeah, so I was a little bit... A lot. Not prepared for that. I hoped for it, but I didn't know I'd react that way.
So funny. Well, that wraps up our episode. We'd like a special thank you to go out to Diana for joining us.
Absolutely. Thank you so much. And yeah, hopefully in the future we'll have a chance to speak with her again.
Love to.
Thank you so much for listening. We look forward to our next episode. Visit our website at www.outlanderpod.com. Follow us on Twitter at @outlanderpod. Find us on Facebook at facebook.com/outlanderpod or email us at outlanderpod@gmail.com.